Perhaps if you open up to Colossians chapter 3. In those times I've been filling in for Mike, I've been slowly working through Colossians, something that's unfolding over years now. So today I just want to consider four verses from Colossians chapter 3, the first four verses. So let's read them together. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. To help us just think through these verses and kind of as a framework to hang our thoughts on, I want to just start off with an imaginary situation. Imagine two people sitting down on a plane next to one another. They don't know one another, but they have a long flight ahead. And one of them turns to the other and says, "Who are you?" Matt, perhaps if it was you, what would you answer? What are the things that stand to make up our identity as people? We might think to talk about our career. As we look at the television, Ancestry.com, and maybe some amongst us would say, a lot of what we are is down to our ancestry. Who were your predecessors? Sometimes that'll become apparent just by looking at you. Sometimes it'll become apparent as you begin to speak and your particular accent comes out. It'll certainly make it apparent where you grew up. Maybe, though, our identity is rooted in where we're going in life. So one person on the plane, he might answer, "Well, my wife and I are moving to America. We have a new life there and we're going to live there." Someone else might answer on the plane, though, "I'm going to America to see my daughter and her husband and my grandchildren. I want to see them before I die because the doctor has told me I have maybe 4 or 6 months to live." That's a very profound defining time in someone's life if death is coming up and is imminent. And he might then, though, say, imagine in our little fictitious story, he might say, "I've got this particular cancer," and some long medical name comes out. And so that cancer is, for all, a death sentence, at least as far as he understands and his doctor understood. But again, if I can stretch the story even further, how would it change things if the person he was sitting next to had spent the last year doing clinical studies in that very cancer, and he answers, "It's no longer a death sentence. I'm going to a conference in America. I'm going to report on our study where in the last year we've been giving this new drug to 30 patients, and without exception, the cancer over 6 months, it diminished and became undetectable." How would that change that man's outlook? It would turn around, in a sense, a big chunk of what defined his identity. And it turns out then that his perception also of his identity and his destiny was wrong, and it had to be informed by information coming from outside him. It had to be changed. Well, we find so much in our scriptures, and particularly here in Paul's letter, that Paul is kind of saying the same thing. That your perception of your identity and your destiny needs to be revised. You need to think again about it. You need to stop and consider who you really are. There's perhaps four things in here that he says that might relate to who we are and what our destiny is. He says in verse 1 and 3 that there's been actually a change of identity. You died, you were raised. Again, he says in verse 3, your life is hidden with Christ in God. In verse 4, he says, Christ is your life. And again, in verse 4, he talks about how our destinies are wrapped up with Christ. He says, when he appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. So I want to just look at these four points in a little more detail. First of all, there has been a change of identity. If you stop and think about what Paul says in verse 3, it's pretty abrupt. He says, you died. But fortunately, in verse 1, he also says, you have been raised. Paul talks about our old identity, if you like, in Colossians 1, verse 21, where he says, you were once alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works. Those terms, alienated, enemies, and it was thorough, it was internal in your mind and external through works. They were defining things about us. But if we can just go back and read Colossians 2, a few verses 12 to 14, it talks about this change of identity. Paul says there, you were buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God, who raised him from the dead. And you being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven all your trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. I dealt with those scriptures last time, but those are the scriptures on which this point that Paul's making now, that we have this new identity, that's the basis of it all. The fact that being united to Christ, we are united with him in all that he accomplished in his death and resurrection. So when he died, the condemnation, our condemnation that he was carrying on his shoulders, that was all done away with. It was finished with. And so when we are united with Christ, that great list of wrongs that we have done, that's finished. It's done away with. As Paul says in those verses, it was taken out of the way. So there is no more list to condemn us. Paul says in Colossians 1:22, he uses the term that we are now presented before God irreproachable. Irreproachable means without reproach. No one can bring an accusation against us. There is no more list of sins. And so this is done away with on the cross. And as he died and rose again, when we are united with him, we are in a sense counted as having died and risen with him, and we are given new life. And this is true for every Christian. Christ did for us what we could not do. He paid the penalty for sin. And it's not just the sins, perhaps up to that point when we believed, it is all sin. We could use the expression from cradle to grave. And so our forgiveness, our mercy, our new life is a consequence of the fact that God counts us as being united to Christ when we put our faith in him. And all these blessings that we're talking about, this new life, this change of identity, we're not talking about what might be called the platinum package of Christianity. There was a problem going on in Colossae that caused Paul to write this letter where they were saying, if I fast enough, if I'm circumcised, if I light a candle and pray 10 times a day, then maybe I can get this better Christianity, attain to this higher standard of faith, these greater blessings. But we can't get these things that way because we cannot earn them. They are all a gift to us from Christ. Only he could bring them about. There is no standard package and platinum package where all these blessings are poured on us. It is all the gift of God through Christ. It's our Christianity. So it's beyond us to get it, to somehow earn it by all these artificial religious exercises. Christ must secure it, and he must give it, and he does, when we put our trust in him for it. So we are counted as having died and been raised with Christ. There's a new identity that we have. But perhaps the second thing that we might look at that Paul has asserted here is in verse 3. He says, your life is hidden with Christ in God. So our life is wrapped up with Christ. Who we are, where we are going, is all hidden in Christ. When something's hidden, Paul chose that word hidden. So when something is hidden, it's not apparent, not immediately apparent. But just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not real. So when we hide and we step behind that tree, or when we close that cupboard door behind us, we don't cease to exist, even though we might be out of sight. And there's something about our life in Christ, that's true in that way. It might help us to think about the Gospels. So many, when they met Christ as he was here on the earth here, they saw different people in him. Some just saw the carpenter's son. Some saw someone who was a threat to their prestige, an annoyance to them. To his brothers, who at that time didn't believe, he was just Jesus. But then in John 8:53, in one of these discourses about who he was with the Jews and the Pharisees, Jesus stepped out from behind the tree and he said, "Before Abraham was, I am." And here was someone who wasn't just this man they were looking at. He was someone who was eternal, the Son of the eternal God. In that same conversation, another thing that Jesus said is that you are from beneath, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world. And there's a sense where, as that was true for Christ, he was from another world. Paul is telling us that that's true for us as well, that we are to set our minds on things above. So not everything about our lives, about our identity, is apparent. But there's another sense in which something can be hidden, and that is we might hide something to make it safe. So if we think thieves are going to come in, I don't know if you do something like this, but when we lock up the back door with the deadlock, we just sort of chuck the keys behind some of the junk that's on the counter, so it's not as easy to find them. When things are hidden, they can be secure from threat. Well, Paul says we are hidden with Christ in God, hidden in God. This life hidden in God is safe from all the troubles that the world can throw at it. When Mike was he's going through Acts, he recently considered when Peter was talking about the death of Jesus, and he spoke about these verses from Acts chapter 1, 23 and 24, where he says, "Him being delivered by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken and put to death." God was in control all the time, even through the events of Jesus' death, even though the Pharisees, to them, it was eliminating a problem. They thought they were in control. They thought they were dealing with their threat. To their prestige. But all the time God was in control. God was working out his plans. It was according to his determined counsel and foreknowledge. Well, again, our life wrapped up in Christ with God is secure. It's secured by God, by the most, if you like, formidable strength in the universe. And so Paul can say at the end of Romans chapter 8, "Who will separate us from the love of God? Shall trouble, distress, persecution, famine?" He goes on to say, "I'm persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus." That's the last few verses of Romans 8. So you see, this life that God has given us is safe, it's secure. It's secure with Christ in God. Perhaps a third thing we might consider is Paul makes this statement in verse 4 as he opens the verse. He says, "When Christ, who is our life, appears." And we might just read over that middle section of that clause there. When Christ, how is he defined? He is defined as being our life. So Christ is our life. What could that mean? There's perhaps two ways we might look about it, in that firstly we might think Christ is the source of our life, the energy behind our life. Or we might also think of that in the sense of Christ is the centre of our attention. You know how we might say of a lad, that car is his life, or when the girl comes along it becomes that girl is his life. So there are two ways we could think of Christ being our life. Let's just think of that first one, that he is the source of our life. We've been talking about identity and what makes up our identity, and well, our ego might want to have something to say about our identity. And our ego will tell us that our identities are wrapped up in what we can do, what we can accomplish, or what we have done. I'm going to build that big mega company when I grow up. I'm going to get a big house and a Porsche. I've already got a Porsche. That's not me. We think of all of these things that we are going to do, all our plans and all our accomplishments, and we think they define us. But in reality, we are none of these things. Back earlier in Colossians in chapter 1, 16 and 17, he has said of Christ, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist. That includes us. In him we consist. He gives us existence moment by moment. He gives us the power to do anything. So what does that say about our egos? But also in those verses it says all things were created for him. That means that all things are his things, including us. We are Christ's things. So what again does that say about our self-determination? We are powerless to act outside his will. And that would be frightening if you stop to think about it, if we didn't know who he was. And it would be even more frightening if we stopped to think about the offensiveness of our sin to a pure God. But there is more to Christ than just judge. We do know who he is. In Colossians 1, 20 and 22 it says of him, he has made peace through the blood of his cross. You who were once alienated and enemies, he has reconciled. Christ is peacemaker and reconciler. He has taken from us condemnation and given us life. So Christ is our life sustainer, is our life giver, is a wonderful one to have in such a role. And it's not stingy in what he gives us. In Colossians 2, 9 and 10, Paul has already said, in him all the fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have been filled in him. That's the New English Bible translation, which actually brings out a play on the word fullness, that God has made all fullness to dwell in Christ, and we have been filled in him. Christ is not stingy blessing us. In Ephesians, writing his letter there, Paul starts out by saying that we have been blessed with every spiritual blessing in heavenly places in Christ. So Christ is our life, and it's not just physical, maintaining us physically day by day, but even more so, Christ is our life spiritually. So that's perhaps the third thing that Paul tells us about ourselves, about our identity. But the last thing I want to maybe focus on that Paul tells us there is that our destiny is wrapped up with his. In verse 4 there in Colossians 3, he says, when Christ appears, you also shall appear with him in glory. In that little fictitious story we were looking at when we started out this morning, we looked at how destiny can be such a defining thing in terms of who you are. So one was starting a brand new happy life in America. Another one was going to see his children before he died. Well, our destiny is defined by Christ. You know, in the history of the earth, this earth, there's perhaps a handful of pivotal events. You might think that the first one was creation, the start of it all. perhaps from a spiritual perspective, the covenants with Abraham and Moses and the cross, we would put these as headline events in history. Well, here Paul tells us that the next headline event in history, when Christ appears to make that great culminating event in the history of this earth, that there we will be at his side. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 and 17. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. So there our destiny is laid out for us. Our destiny is to meet him in those clouds, and then, from then on, to always be with him. I don't want to skip too fast over to what Paul says about that. He says, you shall appear with him in glory. Paul's not ashamed to add this. It will be a glorious time, and to be with him will be glorious. And it's part of that blessing that God pours out on us. Remember, we said he's not stingy in giving life. When two people get married, there's a sense where they wrap up their destiny together. The old vows used to read that they would be faithful from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to death do us part. So as we said, our identity might be defined in part by our destiny. One of the aspects of marriage is that when two people get married, they merge their destinies. So when one is happy, it will make the other happy. When one suffers, the other one will also suffer. So when one is physically hurt or when one is sick, the other won't be able to help but be emotionally hurt. And in our Western culture, I don't know if it's worldwide, some of you might be able to enlighten me on that, but in our Western culture, in the tradition that we've had, is we would signify this by the two people taking on a common name, a common surname. So there has been a merging of identity. The two identities have become one. They are no longer separate, independent beings. Well, the amazing thing is that Christ has undertaken to have this same relationship with his people. A little earlier, Dave read for us from Ephesians chapter 5. And in that reading, Paul said, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does, the church. For we are members of his body and of his bones. And Paul goes on to say, this is a great mystery, but I speak of Christ, concerning Christ and the church. When Paul wandered in Ephesians in what was getting towards the practical section at the end, he wanted to counsel husbands and wives about how they should live together and relate. He couldn't help but talk about this wondrous thing that is Christ, in a sense, marrying the church. So he has bound his destiny up with ours. Not only is our destiny bound with him. You know, when we get married, we say those words, for better or for worse, but as we are saying them, really there's a sense where we're really thinking about the for better coming first, and that for worse stuff, that's way, way off when we get old and decrepit. There are some exceptions where people will marry when difficulties are right at the door, but normally we think the for worse is back towards the end. But for Christ, when he takes us on, the for worse is happening up front. It's happening first. Because as he binds himself to our well-being, he must take on the trouble that's brought about by our guilt. And he didn't just take on the sadness of it. You know, we thought just a minute ago that When one gets physically ill in a marriage, the other may be made sad by that, but they are not themselves physically ill. But Christ did not just take on the emotional impact of the damage that we'd done by our sin, the sadness of it. He took on the whole debt and the suffering that would have to be suffered in order to pay that debt. So as Paul wrote, Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. So see how Christ has proven his integrity, his faithfulness in the relationship, as he bound his destiny with ours. And even now today as we meet, our destiny is bound up with his. Today he is nourishing us and feeding us through the word as we sing hymns and as we consider his scriptures. It's Christ who is giving us life. It is a hidden work at the moment in a sense, but when he comes, it will no longer be hidden. Those words from Thessalonians speak of a lot of noise. There will be a shout. It will be all and open for everyone to see. And our life with Christ, as I say, will no longer be hidden in that sense. So here are some things that define our identity. You died and you were raised. Your life is hidden with Christ in God. Christ is your life. And your destiny is bound up with his. When he appears, then also you will appear with him in glory. What are the consequences of, if you like, this new identity that we have? Well, in the church, this new identity surpasses so many other things that we might have previously used to define our identity. In verse 11 of chapter 3 there in Colossians, Paul says, "There's neither Greek, nor Jew, nor circumcised, nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, nor free, but Christ is all and in all." So our former religious background, our former race, how cultured we might be or how uncultured we are, if we were a prime minister or a cleaner, all of those things are pushed out of the way because Christ is all and Christ is in all. Christ is the central defining thing of our identity. And if we start to dismiss other believers in our midst because of these other things, we might be dismissing those who Christ has died for. In practice, this means that Christians are going to be brought together from different backgrounds with different perspectives, and it is going to make some of our relationships harder than others. And that is why we need to exercise tender mercy and long-suffering. But we must not be dismissing other Christians just because maybe we find them hard to get on with. Because the central point of our identity is what we share in Christ. Let's just reread verses 1 and 2 together in chapter 3, 1 and 2. "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth." Paul's giving us some directives there. Seek those things which are above. Set your mind or your affection on things above, not on things of the earth. So we have this new identity and we need to live and think in that framework. And really Paul goes on in the rest of the chapter to elaborate on that, to spell out how that might work for a Christian in a Christian life. And that's what I want to look at perhaps next time. But just now I just want to stop and think what it might mean then to be seeking the things above, or to be setting our mind on things above. Jesus gives us a parallel exhortation in the Sermon on the Mount. He says in Matthew 6, 19 to 21, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal." So heaven is our destiny, and so we need to think about the investments that we make here in this life. So does this mean that what we need to do is become a monk and move to a monastery and spend all our days singing psalms in Latin? Well, Paul does actually go on in Colossians to urge us to have our hearts and minds singing to Christ in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. But to become a monk? No. We have responsibilities. Paul reminds the Thessalonians how they acted when they stayed with them. He says to them, "We did not eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked in with labour and toil, night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither should he eat." So we do have responsibilities in life. So then, does this then mean that I'm to work, and then when I'm done working, I'm to sing psalms and take no pleasure in this life? No, we're not to become monks. Again, Ecclesiastes 9, 7 and 9. "Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all the days of your vanity." There's kind of a bitter sweetness in those verses, isn't there? He talks about, in one way, the joy, taking pleasure and joy in the things that God has given us, and then all of a sudden he returns to the lessons that he learned through his own experience, that if we overinvest in these things, if we make the world our God, whatever your world is to you, whatever your idol might be, whether it's houses or cars or families, if we make these things our God, we will find them to be empty and vain in the end. So we can take pleasure in the things that God has given us, but there is a warning that if we turn these things, these blessings, into our God, then we will ultimately find them empty. It might help us to think of the difference between renting and buying a house. When we rent a house, we might spruce it up a bit. We might put up artworks on the walls that make it look pretty, put the furniture in that we like. We might even put a rug down, maybe. But always when we invest, if you like, in that rental house, we limit our investment in that house because we know we can't take it with us if we invest in some of the permanent parts of the house. So all the things that we do in that rental house, we are guarded about what we do, about the money that is outlaid, about the time that is outlaid. Because one day that house will return to its owner. But when we buy a house, there's a different rule set, if you like, isn't there? We know that as we put money, as we put effort into that house, that there is a promise of a reward for us, the promise of a return. Well, in a sense, this life is like a rental. We need to carefully watch what we invest in the things in this world, lest so much of the time and money that we have spent comes to naught. So our identity as God's children needs to colour the decisions that we make. Should I take that new job, that promotion? Where should I live? Should I buy that house that's going to take all my time renovating, or build that house that's going to take all my time project managing? Will it rob me of time with God's people and with Him? Will I be too exhausted to pray at the end of each day, too tired for people? If we invest ourselves heavily in this world, we might find out that this world was always our God, and the true God never was. It might take all our attention captive. And so in that same part of the Sermon on the Mount that I read from earlier, Jesus warned us that you cannot serve God and riches. So we have to be careful about what we invest in this world, because our identity is not wrapped up here. Well, Paul tells us to seek those things above because that's where Christ is. He is the object of our seeking. He is the best joy of the many joys of heaven. But Christ is accessible to us now. He is the one you can bring all your fears to. He is the one that you can speak of all your joys and hopes to. He is the one who has suffered for us. So will he be disinterested in your prayers now before we meet him in the sky? And Paul tells us Christ is seated at the right hand of God. He's in a position of influence and authority. All power and blessing resides in that place. So we can seek Christ now. We don't have to wait for that day. We can seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. We can begin now and focus on him. So next time you sit down on a bus or a plane, and the person says to you, next to you says, "Who are you? What are you going to say?" Will you say that my life is hidden with Christ in God? In fact, he is my life. My destiny is bound up with his, and when he appears in the clouds, then also I'm going to appear with him in glory. For I died and I've been raised to a new life. Well, irrespective of what you say to that person, these are the things that defines who we are if you put your faith in Christ. Well, he has certainly blessed us, hasn't he?